that's all about financial and reputational risk. Garmin, I don't know if they're still down. They were down for 3 or 4 days. The runners and the bikers and the people using their sport watches couldn't log what they were doing. But airlines or people with, you know, small planes rely on Garmin to do their flight routes. So that type of outage for them to not have access to GPS, I assume, is going to be a huge finance and for sure reputational risk.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. My guest today, David Kane, is the CEO and co-founder of Ethical Intruder. Ethical Intruder is a white hat cybersecurity firm that does hacking on behalf of its clients to find soft spots in their cybersecurity protection so that they can protect themselves before a nefarious actor exploits their weak point. David's been at this more than a decade. He has a lot of hard-earned lessons. And in this conversation, we talk about how he sells cybersecurity services, the important reason that a nonprofit would need to protect itself, and why the Internet of Things exposes everyone to more vectors of attack. I found this really insightful. I think you will as well. Here is my conversation with David Kane.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. I'm excited to be talking with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I appreciate you having
it. I wanted to start off with how fantastic your company name is. It is clear. It paints an exceptionally vivid picture of who you are and the role that your company plays. So maybe we can just start off a little bit explaining what Ethical Intruder is and does, and then maybe a little bit about how you came to that name.
Sure. So Ethical Intruder is we're a cybersecurity company. We focus on cybersecurity compliance and risk. And when we started out 10 years ago, the original founders of the company came out of a software engineering product development type of field. And we were building products for other customers, small customers, large customers, government entities. And we realized that there was sort of a division in IT between software engineering and network infrastructure. And most people in cybersecurity were on the network side, whereas we were on the software engineering product side. And we realized that when we were delivering products to our customers, we were handing them over to security teams that maybe knew nothing about what they were protecting. So we wanted to find a way to build a company where we could have the same type of skill sets that hackers have, because they very often have that type of background. So we started out doing penetration testing and ethical hacking, and that's where the name comes in. So it's a play on ethical hacking, which is basically hacking, but with permission. And very often we talk about malicious intruders. So we just took the ethical from ethical hacking and the intruders from malicious intruders and put them together. But you're right, yeah, people really like the name. So I thought that worked out pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, the first time that I saw the name was at the Pittsburgh Tech Council's Tech 50 Awards, and there was the piece of cake there. And I was like, I think I already know what they do, which is part of the game with naming, you know, the ability to, first of all, you know, is it easy to spell, easy to say, easy to pronounce, easy to remember, but also do I kind of, at least to some degree, get an idea of what this company's about when I first bump into it?
Yeah, no, that was really the idea. I think we had a few variations over the first 6 months or year that we were around, and we finally settled on that. But it's been great. You're right. I mean, people right away, you know, for the ABC company, I mean, there's a lot of companies that it's hard to get to know what they do. Our logo is a white hat hacker, and then we have the ethical intruder, and then usually people who are in the security space or that know a little bit about us have a feeling that it has something to do with cybersecurity.
So tell me a little bit more about, so there was this premise of there was network infrastructure security, there was software security. What were you seeing in terms of, because this is maybe kind of in that same vein of, you know, companies adopting way more software as a service products to kind of meet their business needs. Is that basically what you were seeing in terms of where there would be?
Well, we started the company 10 years ago, and so software as a service wasn't really there yet, right? Everything was called, you know, there were. I think we've gone through many different iterations of what that was called to sort of be in the cloud. But what I did early on was I worked for a company where we were looking at the technology curve and sort of trying to understand where opportunities were coming. And we saw that there was this opportunity probably about 12 years ago to really start to focus more on the security aspect of products and realize that, again, there wasn't really a lot there. The fact that we had a software background and a product background, I thought, really helped us out because, by definition, hackers build malware. Malware is software. They write scripts. And so, again, we just thought that there would be a good balance. So we focus across the entire spectrum for cybersecurity. We just wanted to make sure that we had some folks that sort of knew, both ends of it. And I think, to your point a little bit, maybe not so much being in the cloud, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, the focus really was on networks and firewalls and boundaries. And so one of the things we said a lot when we started out, and we still say this now, is that when you were building software, it was all about, be on time, be on budget, and exceed the customer's expectations. If you can do those three things in software, people are super happy. But we realized that when we were building these products, nobody said, but make them secure, right? On the network side and the infrastructure side, firewalls and everything else, that's a core of what they do. And so as we've talked to companies about that, they realize, we haven't necessarily built that in. And there's a huge amount of catch up in that space. Yet the hackers know that if you're going to go in, you're going to go through the best open door, right? So back then, the biggest open door, it's not really today, but the biggest open door was software applications and basically other ways to get in. So one example would be, a lot of people would say, oh, we have products, but they're in a data center, and the data center is secure, right? So people really focused on data center security. And I would say, but do you have a web application or a website where I can, is there a field that I can enter information into it? And if they said yes, the data center does nothing to protect the fact that I'm at home entering something into Amazon.com. It's going directly into their system. So really, it was just a different way of looking at how you could get into the system. And that's a big part of where we started.
Gotcha. So you talked about this spectrum of cybersecurity, and that was, coming into this interview, I know that I'm probably making, a dozen different mistakes in my own practices and habits that would make your skin crawl. But I know marketing. I spend a lot of time thinking about marketing, and someone can say, well, I'm in marketing, and that could mean one of, 10,000 different things, whether it's the ads creative versus distribution or the style of creation or something like that. It seems like cybersecurity works in a similar way in that there's a lot of different domains. You've already drawn this delineation between the two sides there. But how do you position Ethical Intruder within the context of the kind of wide range of cybersecurity firms that are out there?
That's a great question. So the first thing we usually do when we talk to customers is that we tell them we don't sell any products, right? So we're never going to be the customer that comes in and says, the way you're going to solve your problems is by buying one of these 2, 5, 7 different products. That happens a lot in cybersecurity. They come out and they've got that one thing that's going to protect your email or your firewall or your endpoints. So our big differentiator is that we're services, and we focus those services on three different areas. So when we talk to customers, we explain that there's a technology side, which is where the hacking comes in, protecting, all of the technology that you have. And ethical hacking and pen testing is about, can we get in? And if we can, we'll tell you sort of how it works. Then we tell them that we also work on compliance and risk a lot. So we're not going to sell you a product for it. But a lot of companies today have, especially with COVID, are having requirements to be SOC 2 compliant, HIPAA compliant, NIST compliant. People want to make sure that the company is safe. So we help them to build roadmaps and frameworks to sort of meet their customer demands, because it's a customer requirement to hit that. And then we focused on users. That's the third area. So phishing, social engineering, making sure that's not how they get in. So usually people get that pretty quick, that differentiation. Again, we're not selling any products. We're basically focusing on those three areas. We're focusing on guidance. So we don't care what products you have. We want to make sure that you're using them correctly and that they're configured, correctly. So that's one of the biggest separation, is that we have no product alliance and there's no specific tool that they use. We're just helping them out with the technology that they already have.
The social engineering one's interesting, though, because we just had the big Twitter hack. And the, from the stories that I've read coming out of there, is that there was either a or a few Twitter employees that were compromised in some capacity, and whether they knowingly or unknowingly gave access to God mode for the service over to these hackers, it occurred, and that was the weak point, as opposed to just a weakness in the code itself that allowed this backdoor in that no one was aware of.
Yeah, and so we're always really careful about exactly what happened, because I think the story keeps changing, but I think there's a combination of a couple of things. Typically, this happens through social engineering, but I think the idea that everybody's at home right now is also another player in this. So, you know, Twitter announced first 3 months, 6 months, now a year, everybody gets to, you know, work at home. So it makes it easier to prey on those people to either find a way to social engineer them, or I've heard stories that maybe it was even they were coerced into giving their information. Also, people can just walk into a house where you're working, right? I mean, it could be somebody that you know. It could be anybody. They're getting access to your systems that's usually protected by physical security. So Twitter's actually interesting. There's so many different layers of kind of what could have happened. But it definitely opens up this really interesting door of now that almost everybody is remote, how do we protect them the same way that we are now? And I think people are trying to justify doing things very differently. But if it's not what you would do within your own corporation, there's definitely some things you may want to do differently when someone's working at home. And regardless of what exactly happened, that's probably a big part of what led to the Twitter hack.
So do you think that that's an argument almost like against the long-term, you know, remote workforce for some of these large tech firms, that like they need some of their finest engineers to be within their walls, less so from a like... forget the virus or whatever is going on there, but just particularly from the standpoint of the security of their infrastructure and what they're trying to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer is it is not in any way a sign that we need to move people back into their offices. I think what we need to do is shift and pivot to how we protect people at home. So when the pandemic started, for instance, we jumped out of sales mode immediately and we went into guidance mode, right? The idea was we started out by helping IT companies tell their IT managers, what can you do with your infrastructure to help you out? And then provided guidance for, now how do you train the people at home to do things a little bit differently? That was quickly followed by the Zoom guidance, right? Because everybody was freaked out about using Zoom and it's insecure. And same principle, Zoom is fine. It's how you use Zoom and how you're using the various features. There's just going to be a shift where you have to understand that if you have intellectual property, if you have customer data, if you have information you don't want people to get to, we have to change what we're doing to make sure that we can work at home. There's a lot of different solutions on how to do that. And by solutions, I don't just mean products, but I think it's just a matter of going back and understanding what you're doing and how to change it. The biggest difference right now, I think, is what in IT we call the boundaries of the organization. It used to be the boundaries was maybe your firewall or your network, and then maybe you had a teleworking policy related to what somebody could do at home, but that's very different than the fact that now people have your laptops and your hardware at home. So the boundary maybe now needs to move into that house, and you're talking more about what is the company's responsibility of what they're protecting. Are they, you know, involved in the Wi-Fi and the firewalls and the switches and what people have, the technology in their house? That's a big hurdle for a lot of companies.
Yeah,
it's probably one of the more secure things that you can do. So I think it's just going to be a change. But I think working from home and the ability to be secure working at home is definitely there. But going back to the Twitter piece, if I'm on a laptop and my kids are home and I run out of the room and, you know, someone happens to be in the house, they now have physical access to my system. So there's just, you know, different variations you need to think about how you're protecting at home.
And it's interesting, you said you made this transition out of sales mode to kind of education and helping people adjust. I would imagine that there's a wide spectrum of how fertile the ground is for this story of cybersecurity. And I was even looking at your site for some of the kind of arenas that you help with.
Right.
It would make sense that if you're working with the Department of Defense, or you're working in healthcare and the HIPAA compliance, or if you're working in financial services, that it is hopefully more apparent how extremely necessary and relevant the cybersecurity of the device is versus other industries where I mean, maybe it does fall on deaf ears, or maybe just isn't held with the same gravity as those kind of more intimate pieces of information.
So it's interesting that you brought that up. Our first three customers sort of taught me a lesson about, you know, sort of what you're discussing. The first customer that we had was a customer in international customer in Canada, who wanted us to break into a data center in Poland. That was really cool. I mean, that was like the first thing that we did was like an international breaking into a data center. Our second customer was Humana. So big Fortune 50 company. And of course, we thought at the time, everyone's going to be like this. This is great. Third customer was a local charitable food bank. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, and they contacted us, right? So I'm thinking, you know, I understand Humana. They had 800 different systems they're trying to protect. And so when we talked to the food bank and we said to them, hey, we're happy to help you, but, you know, a penetration test for a food bank, this is how naive we were at the time. And they said, here's the thing. Food banks rely on donations and donations alone, right? We're coming up on Thanksgiving. We're coming up on the season where people give. And they said, we have a couple of concerns. If somebody finds out that our system was hacked, because everybody pays online now. If they find out that we're not secure, we don't get donations. If we don't get donations, then this whole season, as it gets cold and it's the holidays, we don't have anything. I'm thinking, that's really insightful, right?
Yeah.
And then they also said, also, people want to be anonymous when they donate. What they told us was, it's very interesting. You have a lot of very conservative people that donate to things that may seem a little bit more liberal and vice versa. And people, if they donate, they want to make sure that that list doesn't get out. And we were like, that's really interesting. And then the next thing they told us is, we also don't want a list of names to get out, because as soon as you steal a list of names of people who donated to one charitable nonprofit, if somebody gets that list, they call up another one and say, do you want a list of people who just donated? And that really just opened up for us about what cybersecurity was all about. So you're right. I mean, we do have Department of Defense contractors and financial service customers and healthcare customers, and I think they take the protection really seriously. But if you have any type of intellectual property, like all the small companies coming out of Pitt and CMU that are building all of these amazing things, if you have, again, a charitable nonprofit and you simply want to protect your information, if you have customer data, medical data, it's really anybody who wants to protect themselves from either harming their customers or themselves or their employees, like the food bank, really would be interested. So we've found that over the years, it's I think as people hear that story, they sort of realize, oh, we have something to protect as well. We have something that could potentially put us out of business. That it's just interesting, right? So as soon as you said, like, oh, all these high-profile customers, which we have, that's great, but it's really everybody. And,
yeah.
One of the hacking things that you hear a lot is that, you know, for small and medium businesses, 50% of them that had a breach will go out of business within a year. 75% of them will go out of business within 2 years.
Wow.
So it's just, you know, it's tough. And it's, you know, we get a lot of people from a lot of different sizes, a lot of different industries focused. And I think the key is that what we do is really about protecting reputation and financial strength. So if you can sell it that way, or digest it that way. And I think that's exactly what happened with the food bank, right? They were like, this is a financial issue for us and a reputation issue. If someone finds out our site, you know, could go down, we're done with. So,
yeah. It seems like it's also in certain ways reflexive to the marketing. I keep bringing it back. That's just what is most relevant from my professional experience is in marketing, you want an event generally.
Sure.
Like, wow, we went viral. Wow, we, you know, got the news. Wow, we got the whatever. And in your instance, it's almost kind of the opposite. We're providing our services for you, but we don't want an event. We don't want a data breach. We don't want things going down. We don't want a hack.
Right.
And so that almost creates partially the idea that no news is good news, but also this challenge of, if I can demonstrably say, like, hey, we created this result for you, then, hey, that's cool. We're going to get referrals, get more business. But in your case, it's almost like, well, hey, nothing's happened. So that's really good, right? And it's kind of a catch-22.
Correct. Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. We, our big thing, like I said, is protecting from that event happening. So we use those terms a lot. Like, so for instance, when somebody says, well, you know, there's a small change we could make, but it's going to disrupt people a little bit, we'll often say things like, so when the board finds out that there was a breach, your answer will be, we decided that it was going to disrupt people for 20 minutes, and that's the reason why we didn't implement this, right? We try to get out that business reason to realize that how impactful would that, you know, that event be. And recently, there was an event, the Garmin GPS hack, which happened, which really ransomware. So again, it probably started with email and phishing. That's all about financial and reputational risk. Garmin, I don't know if they're still down. They were down for 3 or 4 days. The runners and the bikers and the people using their sport watches couldn't log what they were doing. But airlines or people with, you know, small planes rely on Garmin to do their flight routes. So that type of outage for them to not have access to GPS, I assume, is going to be a huge finance and for sure reputational risk. And so when you think of those events and you start to think about what could happen and what the story could be, I think it helps people to have a little bit of insurance that they're going to stay away from that story and they can continue to grow.
How does your exposure to this field impact how conservative you are with the data that kind of surrounds your own life? So whether it's a Garmin or one of these wearables that's collecting all sorts of data on your habits and what have you, like how does that impact your own choices as an individual?
I think it makes you a lot more aware. You know, we've heard stories from the very beginning about the Nest thermostats and the Ring doorbells and all of, you know, we hear them early on. So I guess we're probably, most of us in the industry, myself included, are a little bit leery about some of those IoT devices.
Yeah.
There's some great stories about people breaking into that. So one of the things that I mentioned was 10 years ago, 12 years ago, software, it was a race to get to market and on time, on budget, exceed expectations. IoT devices, which are the watches and the doorbell, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's security is important, but if they have a great idea and somebody else has a similar idea, they're trying to get it out to market. And there's just a lot of holes and a lot of vulnerabilities. And so I think it makes us a little bit more leery. I mean, you now have little Android apps inside of refrigerators and, you know, they have to connect to your Wi-Fi. And then you have friends that come over and kids that are on your Wi-Fi. And now we have people at home working, doing, again, whether it's the Department of Defense or whether it's somebody working for a food bank, potentially on that same network. That's on a network as a Ring doorbell, and it's a lot easier for me to break into the Ring doorbell and then to get to the person working on their laptop. So again, I think it's had a big impact on some of those decisions, but it also helps us to tell those stories to customers about what to do at home and what some of the dangers are about what they include into their home environment when they're doing their work there.
It just seems like there's so many vectors for attack.
It's crazy. And hackers or ethical hackers never pick the vector that's hard to break, right? So it's great that everybody has firewalls and routers and all of these things. That's not how people are traditionally trying to get in anymore. I mean, they're still getting pinged all the time. But, you know, phishing and social engineering or IoT devices are just so easy. Like if I wanted to hack you, for sure, not you personally, for sure it would be, you know, by email. And right now, because of COVID, the amount of phishing and social engineering attacks that are going on is tremendous. And the reason why is IT looks at phishing and social engineering very often as an IT issue, and HR looks at it as a training issue, but it's a people issue. It's a behavioral issue. So it's just like raising a pet or having a child. Our behaviors have us do the things that we do, whether we realize it or not, like the little child that's, you know, reaching out to touch the stove until they learn not to do it. So we learn about phishing, but all of a sudden we get something that says Allegheny County has released new data on, you know, school, whatever it might be. And you just forget that you're not supposed to click on stuff and you click on it, right? Or, you know, the CEO of the company has sent out something about returning to work. Just enter your credentials in order to get the information. Well, it should never make any sense to put in your credentials to read something by the CEO. But behaviorally, with what's going on with COVID, and behaviorally just in general, hackers try to find ways to throw people off, and that's just absolutely the easiest way to get into anything right now.
And especially when everyone's habits and everyone's like just day to day is off kilter, it's much harder to recognize, man, this, the wording in this is right. just off or something right. like that.
And that sort of goes back to the Twitter. Like, I don't think we necessarily know what happened, but if it was an insider piece and if it had something to do with social engineering or it had something to do with coercion, the fact that that person who had admin credentials was at home definitely leans towards somebody creating a vector that would allow them to create that breach.
Makes sense. In terms of staying up on like the latest methods of attack, how do you and your team stay on top of that? Because I'm sure so much has changed in the 10 years of, right. of Ethical Intruder in terms of like the vectors, the IoT devices, what have you. Like, where are you going to know the latest methods of hacking that are going down?
So there's a lot. I mean, it's endless. And so I think everybody in this space probably goes to, you know, to different places. I myself, I have a few favorite from a business side sites that I go to. So one of them is just CSO, Chief Security Officer Online. So I go to that probably every day, a couple of times a day. They have great content about how cybersecurity is interacting with business. And then just talking to our customers, I mean, we have so many customers now that we're constantly hearing about how people are trying to get in, researching about new vulnerabilities. But, and the community, the Pittsburgh community is great. There's a lot of, you know, user groups and meetup groups and, you know, conferences. And of course, this year has been a little bit different. But I think we're all really good about trying to share information with each other. If you're looking to keep up with the information, finding the information is easy for sure. But CSO Online for me is probably something at my level, something that helps me out a lot. Just a real quick hit. I could scroll through in 3-4 minutes and get some good information before I start my day.
Right on. One more question, then we'll aim towards wrapping up, David. In terms of getting this company off the ground, you talked about the three initial customers and the varying nature of them. But in those early stages when you're transitioning into running this business and, you know, keeping the lights on and getting this thing going, what contributed to your capacity to make that? Because, you know, you've talked about some of these stats of how many businesses go out of business after a major data breach, all the numbers about, you know, the amount of businesses that can't survive the first year or the second year. What was it that got you through that period of time?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it was just, you know, I don't know if it works for everybody, but staying true to our mission at the very beginning, because you get a lot of distractions along the way of moving in different directions, or you've invested some money and it's not working and you quickly want to move into another direction. We knew early on that we wanted to work more on the business executive level because we felt that this was going to go from an IT issue to a boardroom issue. It wasn't that way 10 years ago. 10 years ago, you went to a CEO or to the board and they said, you know, talk to my IT guy. But we just knew there was going to be that shift. So everything that we did was focused on how do you relate our information to business end users as much as the technology folks? And I think that as much as we stuck to our guns over time, it really helped us to find the niche of those people that were starting to move into that area. And then the industry did, you know, move towards us. So I think just sticking to our principles of what we wanted to do, how we wanted to do it. You know, everybody approaches this differently. We did not raise capital. We still haven't raised capital. We have no other outside investors, no VCs, no angel investors. So we've been able to control what we want to do and how we want to grow. I'm not saying that wouldn't happen at some point, but having ownership of what we're doing and staying true to what we wanted to do, I think has really helped us out the most.
And was that the plan from the jump? Because so like Hannah and I, my co-founder, we started saying like, we're not going to raise any outside funding. We really want to optimize for autonomy, because whether that's, you know, staying true to your kind of values and principles or just the capacity to like follow your gut, like I think this is the direction that we need to be going and not have to get that co-signed by someone.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, this was the plan from the beginning. We've never wavered. You're exactly right. We've done things like we created a compliance model called the Cyber Liability Maturity Model 5 years ago, and we've really used that to build security and compliance frameworks. All of these things that we've built on, we wanted to make sure that we could own it, we could control it, we could figure out how it works. That's not to say that if we didn't take money, we couldn't grow faster and hire more people and do more things, but that idea of owning what we were doing and controlling our destiny has just always been something that was important to us. It's been working out, and we'll probably continue to do it.
Right on. If folks want to learn more about Ethical Intruder, just stay on top of all the things you guys are doing, what digital coordinates can we provide people who want to learn more?
Yeah, I think, so we're on Twitter, so you can just, search Ethical Intruder on Twitter. That's our handle. LinkedIn is the same thing. You can go to LinkedIn. We probably push out the most content on LinkedIn. We're also on Facebook. And, I always still keep it so that I work with every customer that we've acquired as the CEO. So I tell people they can reach out to me as well. So david.kane@ethicalintruder.com. People can feel free to reach out and welcome to, talk with anybody that has questions.
So you're cool with the email being out there in the world? That's not a security concern?
Yeah, no. so thanks for bringing that up. I think it's fine. Our email, you can find it on our website. I guess we don't need to repeat that as well, but my phone number, my email, if people want to contact me, they know how to get a hold of me. I think I mentioned earlier, we had a customer that had a security issue. It was the last thing I did before I went to bed. It was the first thing I did when I woke up. So we're really tuned in, and we want to make sure that if somebody needs to get a hold of us, we're always available for them.
Beautiful. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for
thanks for having me.
Sharing some time with us. Before we let you go, I want to give you the mic one final time to issue an actionable personal challenge for the audience.
Sure. So one of the things I've been thinking about lately is, we try to do this. It's so hard with COVID right now a great thing for people to do would be to just find a way to sort of build people up, or find a way to just reach out to a customer that you can build up, or somebody that's done something for you in the past, and just reach out to them and help to build them up. I think right now people are yearning and looking for something positive. And I think it's definitely something that, would make sense for people to try to do.
Yeah. Whenever, and I should be more consistent about it, but whenever I send a thank you card to someone that isn't like, hey, you gave me a gift at my birthday or whatever, right, but just like a kind of unprompted display of gratitude for that person, I'm always like taken by how much they appreciate that, how much they enjoy it. And it speaks to how infrequent it is that people make that extra effort and take that step. So I think that's a great challenge. Beautiful. We just went deep with David Kane. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Hey, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. In addition to listening to this podcast every Monday, you should be subscribed to our newsletter, Expand Your Mind, where you'll get a fresh dose of new perspectives and ideas every Tuesday morning in your inbox. You can subscribe by going to pipercreative.co/newsletters.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram @AaronWatson59.